It's hard for me to express just how happy Twyla and I are to be here with you tonight, how grateful we are that you've allowed us to come. When I was greeting many of you, you saw me and you came up to me, and the first thing you said was, "Where's Twyla?" She's right over there. But when David Driscoll texted me, I guess, 2 or 3 months ago and said, told me about what y'all are doing on Sunday nights, and you're having some people come back and speak, he said, you know, you can do this remotely or you can do this in person. And I said, well, I'm not going to pass up a chance to be here. Twyla said the same thing, because you all mean so much to us. We spent about 15 years here, and you all minister to us so very well. And you still minister to us because we think about you. And we think about the experiences we had together and the ways that we served together. And it's just a precious memory, precious memories for us. This place is certainly, or the time we spent here is certainly a highlight of our lives, no question about it. Twyla and I are members of the Auburn Church of Christ now. We're making lots of relationships there, but this place will always hold a very, very special place, and you all are the reason for that. Tonight I'm not sure this is a sermon. These are some observations from the book of Job and some study that I've done on my own and in recent past. But in preparation for this week's lesson, I was thinking about how we read, understand, and apply the Bible. It occurred to me that so many of the books of the Bible are stories. They're stories about people and God's interaction with those people, their interaction with Him. You think about Genesis and Exodus and all of the stories that we learn when we're young people. Joshua, Judges. I think y'all are spending some time in the book of Judges here. I think I saw that. And lots of great stories there. In the New Testament, obviously, the Gospels. It's a story. The book of Acts, a story. And the book of Job, obviously, is a story. And I think it can be very easy for us to read a story like the book of Job and think it's some fictitious account that is somehow entertaining to read or interesting to discuss. But the book of Job, I believe, is about a real man in a real time. And we need to make sure that when we read the book of Job and any of these other stories in the Bible, that we don't miss the what's in it for us part. And I think that's something to concentrate on, particularly in the book of Job. This book is full of implication and direction for us spiritually. I want us to begin this, and I want to do a quick recap of the book. We're going to camp out a little bit in chapters 38 through 40. But I want to go back over the story, and I know that you all have read this. You're very familiar with it, I'm sure. But we know that God and Satan are having a conversation about this man named Job. Satan is patrolling the earth, and I'm reading between the lines here a little bit, but I suspect he's patrolling the earth, and he's seeing the wickedness of the earth, and he's quite pleased, probably, at what's going on. And so in this conversation that he's having with God, God said, well, wait, hang on just a minute. Have you seen my servant Job? He's a righteous man. He is a man that is full of faith. He is a man who fears me. And Satan says, well, just a minute. He's living the good life. Why wouldn't he be faithful? Why wouldn't he fear you? And God said, okay, I believe his faith runs deeper than that. I'm going to allow you to test him. So we know what happens next. God grants Satan permission to afflict Job. And Satan takes away Job's wealth. He takes away his servants, and he takes away his family all in one day. And there's a key verse here in the book of Job in chapter 1, verse 22. It's one that you all know. It said, in all of this that happened to him, Job did not sin or charge God with wrongdoing. And then we know that there's another conversation between God and Satan. And God said, have you considered my servant Job? He's still faithful. And Satan says, well, you did not let me afflict him physically himself. And if I do that, then he will curse you. And so we know what happened next. Satan attacks Job. He attacks him with a terrible skin disease. He boils and sores break out all over his body. And he, in addition to the emotional and mental misery that he's in because he's lost everything, he's now in great physical misery. And he's having a conversation with his wife, and his wife says, "You need to curse God and die." His response to her is that "you speak as one of the foolish women would speak." And this is in chapter 2. "Shall we receive good from God and not receive evil?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. We know next that three of Job's friends come to him, and they sit with him in silence for 7 days to comfort him: Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. In chapter 3, Job speaks about the misery that he's encountering, and he curses the day he's born, but he still makes no accusation against God. I think a key verse in chapter 3 is in verse 25. Job said, "The thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me." And that resonates with me because we all spend a lot of our lives worrying about what's happening right now and in fear of what's happening to us right now. But we also project into the future and we think about, what's my worst case scenario? What's my worst nightmare? I'm afraid that's going to happen to me. And Job says this. He says, "My worst case scenario has occurred. My worst nightmare has happened." And that resonates with me because I know there are some people in this room whose worst case scenarios have happened. It happened to Job. And then in chapters 4 through 31, there's this back and forth exchange between Job and his first three friends, and they're discussing what's going on with Job, and the friends are essentially saying, "Job, you've got to be guilty of something. You wouldn't be in all of this misery, and all this calamity wouldn't have happened to you if you were truly a righteous man." And Job defends himself vehemently. But their perspective, the friends and Job's perspective, is that the righteous are rewarded and that the evil are punished. And so they can't understand what's going on. But Job's defense is to his friends, but it's also an outcry to God because he doesn't understand what's happening to him. In chapters 32 through 37, we hear from a fourth friend, a man by the name of Elihu. He is younger. Elihu comes in on the scene, and he rebukes the three friends for challenging Job like this. He rebukes Job as well, but he does it in a little bit more understanding and compassionate way. Interestingly, Job is silent during this part of the conversation when Elihu is speaking. So we get to chapters 38 through 40. If this were a novel that you were reading, this would represent the climax of the story. This is when God speaks to him. If you think about it, in the story of Job, after the first two chapters where you have conversations between God and Satan, we only hear from Job, we hear from his wife briefly, we hear from four of his friends, and that's it. God is not present in these discussions at all. We don't know how long it took for God to respond to Job. We know that he lost his possessions, his servants, and his family all in one day. And then we know that he lost his health on another day. We know that three friends heard about his calamity, and they come to him. We don't know the time frame of any of that. We know that when they got there, they sat with him for 7 days. So we know that Job's misery lasted at least 7 days. And we don't know how long the conversations lasted between Job and these four friends. But what we do know is that through 36 chapters of discourse, God's silent. Now, I want to pause just for a bit of an aside here. Remember that Job is probably a contemporary of Abraham. He lived probably in the patriarchal time. And this was before the law of Moses was given. And it's intriguing to me how much Job knows. Job knows, for instance, to fear God and what constitutes evil. He doesn't have the law of Moses to refer to. What would give Job the idea that he ought to offer sacrifices on behalf of his children in chapter 1? How did Job know that God suspended the earth on nothing when the prevailing wisdom of the time was that the earth is supported on a series of animals and not suspended on nothing. Job knew this. And then as we move into the New Testament, we read Jesus' teachings on the Sermon on, in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5 that you've heard it said that if you commit adultery, that's a sin, that's a problem. But I say to you, if you lust on a woman, you've committed adultery with her in your heart already. And Job refers to lust, I think, about three times in the book. In particular, Job chapter 31 and verse 1 says, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look at lust on a young woman. Now, how did Job know that the finer point of sexual purity involved not lusting and not simply committing the physical act? Interesting. Job lives around the time of Abraham, 2,000 years since the creation. And a casual observer might conclude that based on Job's knowledge that God has spoken to him at some point in his life, earlier, before all of the calamity hit him. But if you look at Job chapter 42 and verse 5, after God speaks, Job says, I had only heard about you before, but now I've seen you with my own eyes. So what I get from that is that at this point, Job had only heard, or prior to God speaking, Job had only heard of God or about God. He had not heard from God. But we know that Job had faith, right? Romans 10:17 says faith comes from hearing. So Job had heard. And I can only conclude, he didn't have the law of Moses, I can only conclude that it had been passed down to him, and it had been passed down very accurately, such that Job knew what lust meant and that it was wrong. God speaks to him. All the calamity has happened to him, and God speaks. And he says, the Lord answers Job out of the whirlwind and says, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. Now, this word here for whirlwind means storm, and we know that God spoke to people throughout the Bible, in the Old Testament and even in the New Testament, in a variety of ways. He spoke sometimes through dreams and visions. We know he spoke through a burning bush. He spoke through a fiery cloud, through a donkey. Now he speaks to Job through a whirlwind or through a storm. I think the common thread in all of these instances in the Bible is that the people that heard God had no question that it was God. It was not something out of their own intuition or out of their own minds. It's something that they knew was miraculous. And so Job is confronted by God through this storm. Now, as God's discourse begins here, he challenges Job, saying effectively, Job, you claim to want a trial before me. Well, let's just examine you and see if you're competent to stand trial. Let's see if you can answer some very simple questions. So what do you think Job felt when he first heard God speak? You know, we've already established that God had not spoken to him before. He had heard about God, he'd heard of God, but he hadn't spoken to him. I think the first thing is he must have been absolutely stunned. It would be like you and I hearing God speak. We've heard about God, we've heard of God, we know he's there, but he's never spoken to us directly. And Job was in that situation. So I'm sure he was absolutely stunned. But the second thing is, I think he must have felt great relief, because this God that he's heard about all of his life is now speaking to him and recognizing the calamity that he's encountered, the things that have happened to him. So he must have been very relieved to know that God was there and that he really did care for God. Now, this is a bit of an aside here again. Psychologists say that most of our communication is nonverbal. They say that only about 7% of communication are the words themselves. 38% is the tone in which we say things. or how we say things. And then 55%, a majority, is body language or our physical expression, our facial expression. And you think that sounds a little bit strange, but it's really true when you think about it. And I think we need to be very careful in this day and age with our communication, because so much of it is texting, email, direct messaging on all kinds of social media platforms. And so an example of this would be if David and I, for instance, decided tonight that he and I are going to go somewhere, we're going to go somewhere Friday. And on Thursday afternoon, I text him, and it looks something like this. "Hey, David, ... If it's okay with you, let's meet in the church parking lot tomorrow at 2 o'clock, period. Thanks." Now, if instead Twyla and Mary were planning to go somewhere on Friday, on Thursday, Twyla would text Mary, and it looked more like this. "Hey, Mary, ! I hope your day is going well, ! If it's okay with you, let's meet in the church parking lot tomorrow at 2 o'clock. So excited to see you, smiley face emoji, dancing lady emoji." Now, if you think I'm making fun of her, I'm not. I'm making fun of me. Because I used the words and it communicated. But what Twyla did is she added tone and expression to that message. And we all need to learn from that. But there's a point here that I want to make regarding this. How would you characterize God's initial response to Job? What's his mood? What's his demeanor? In all these chapters and in Job, as with all of the Bible, we only have words. We have the written, we have black and white words. We don't hear God's voice. We don't hear his tone of voice. We don't see any kind of physical expression. But God does us a great favor. He did Job a great favor, and he does us a great favor. This was written to, or these words were to Job. God spoke to Job, but these words are for us as well. And so I would characterize, I don't know any way to describe it other than sarcasm. His response is sarcasm. And we know that Job is a book of poetry, but this sarcasm is used for emphasis. It's here for a reason. It gives us tone. It gives us expression. It helps us understand what God's trying to get across. In essence, God says to Job, "Job, I could really use your help when I created the universe." God is also about to use a lot of examples and a lot of repetition to help us understand, help Job understand, help us understand the futility of challenging and debating God. Because Job heard God's tone of voice. He got the point. The repetition that he's about to go through is probably very overwhelming to Job, but it also helps our understanding of God's point. So let's look at the questioning of Job. There's really three categories of questioning, and there's so much here, and we can't deal with it all tonight. But God questions Job about the wisdom and power in the creation of the universe. And then secondly, God's creation and care for the animal kingdom. And then finally, God's restraint of the forces of evil in the world. And so we're going to look at a little bit of this. I'd invite you to go and open your Bible and read this book. It's quite intriguing when you go back and examine it. Every time I look at it, I see something different, something new. "Job, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched a line upon it? Or on what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Job, have you entered into the springs of the sea? or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all of this. Job, where is the way to the dwelling place of the light? And where is the place of darkness, that you may take to its territory and that you may discern its path to its home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. You see his tone? Sounds like sarcasm, doesn't it? But don't you get the point? Job got the point. Then the Lord said to Job, this is after the first part of what God says, do you still want to argue with the Almighty? You are God's critic, but do you have the answers? Look at Job's reply. Job replied to the Lord, I am nothing. How could I ever find the answers? I will cover my mouth with my hand. I have said too much already. I have nothing more to say. Covers his mouth. Now, I know all of us in here are either students, some students over here possibly. I think they may be having a Devo tonight. You're either a student or you've been a student. How many of you have ever walked into an examination and opened up a test booklet and looked at it and failed to answer even one question? I don't mean you answered the question and you got it wrong. I mean, you didn't even write anything down. Job doesn't even write anything down. He doesn't know what to say. He's silenced by God's display of his created wisdom. He's forced to conclude, in effect, I'm not in the same league as you are, Lord. My puny wisdom is no match for the wisdom that created the universe. Now, here is a stark contrast to me in the book of Job. Job does this. Job is silent. He puts his hand over his mouth. He said, I've said too much. And if you go back to chapter 31, when Job is defending himself and crying out to God, but he's defending himself before God, he's defending himself before his friends, Job said in chapter 31, he said, if I could just confront God face to face, I would give him an account of my every step. Like a prince, I would approach him. Now what does he do? He's stupefied. He doesn't know what to do, what to say. He can't believe he said everything that he said. So once again, God comes to Job in a whirlwind. And God again challenges Job with things he can't answer. God says, are you condemning me so that you'll be in the right? Can you thunder with a voice like God? Are you majestic and clothed with glory and splendor? Are you able to deal with wicked people and put them in their place? So all of this happens to Job. There's a lot of this discourse that obviously I'm not hitting on. But the question comes, I think, for us is that, and for Job, how does God answer Job's question of, why is all this happening to me? Why has all this calamity occurred? Why have I lost my wealth? Why have I lost my servants? Why have I lost my children? Why have I lost my health? I think the first thing to observe is that God doesn't answer the question directly. He does not answer the question directly. God's answer looks a little bit more like this, I think. Job, I'm not going to explain it to you because there's no way for you to understand. Implied here, you must have faith in me even in the middle of adversity. And ultimately, Job, you must trust me. Now, that may sound harsh to you. This is not directly in the Bible. I'm just saying this is what I see in this passage. But I want you to think, if you think that's harsh, I want you to think about your interaction with a three-year-old child, either your three-year-old child or your three-year-old grandchild. And the child wants to eat nothing but sweets. And you sit that three-year-old child down and you say, honey, if you eat nothing but cookies, cake, and ice cream, you're going to elevate your blood sugar. Your pancreas is going to be overworked. And you're going to try to produce enough insulin. And you may become insulin resistant. And that may lead to diabetes. Now, if you're talking to your three-year-old child like that, you're wasting your breath. And I want to tell you something. The wisdom gap between God and me is much greater than the wisdom gap between me and the three-year-old. Isaiah 55, God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declare the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. 1 Corinthians 1, Paul says, for the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. God's response is overwhelming. It's overwhelming in that it's, I don't know how to call it anything other than sarcasm. It's so overwhelming. The repetition, if you read through it, is overwhelming. Overwhelming to Job, no doubt about it. But I think it helps Job understand a couple of things. One is, Job, you need to remember, God said, Job, you need to remember who I am and who you are. In essence, Job needed to let God be God. And then the second thing is, Job, you don't know what you don't know. Now, we know that God knows things that we don't know. God knew things that Job didn't know. God knows the future. God sees spiritual warfare for what it really is. We read about spiritual warfare, but I'm not sure we see everything going on around us and recognize it as spiritual warfare. But God sees it, and we don't. Now, I think some observations for us. The first thing is, what God does is just and right by definition. God is the very definition of justice. God is the very definition of righteousness. The second thing is that I think it's fear that drives us to question circumstances and question God. You know, fear of everything around us, fear of my health, fear of what might happen, fear of what's going to happen in our country. But what we need to understand here is we know that the opposite of fear is courage. But the antidote for fear is not mustering up courage within myself, in and of myself. The antidote for fear is faith. It's faith in God. I've heard Dwayne say from this pulpit, I'll steal this from him. I've heard him say from this pulpit many times, at the end of a service, offering the invitation, the question is, do you trust him? Did Job trust him? Job finally recognized he needed to trust God. The ultimate question, do you trust him? Do you trust that he will do what he said that he's going to do? Do you trust that he's going to work everything out for our good? Do you trust it or do you not trust it? Now, as we mature in Christ, I think our goal should be able to say what Job said in chapter 13. In the middle of all of his emotional, mental, and physical distress, Job says, talking about God, though he slay me, I will hope in him. Well, if you've not placed your initial hope and trust in God, you can do that. You have an opportunity to do that tonight. You could come forward, we could baptize you. You can talk to someone here about that if you're not sure about it. But I suspect most of us in here have done that. But how many of us are losing hope or have lost hope? How many of us find that we're losing trust in God because of life circumstances, the difficulties of life? You've got an opportunity to have this church family pray for you. It's a very, very powerful thing for a church to pray for you. And then one of the great benefits of being a member of a church like this is whatever you're facing right now, the difficulties you might be facing, it's highly likely there's somebody else in this church family that's faced something very, very similar to what you faced or what you're facing today. And I'm sure they would have no problem with having a conversation with you about that. Be helpful. If you have any needs tonight, you have an opportunity to come, and these ministers, elders will serve you and help you. So if you have any need, you can come now while we sing the song.